To start things off this afternoon, with 9/11 rapidly approaching, the anniversary is Monday, the fifth anniversary of the worst attack on American soil. There's been a lot of looking back and looking forward, and today we're going to do exactly that with Louise Richardson. She is Executive Dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, a senior lecturer in government at Harvard, a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School, and has a new book that's just come out called What Terrorists Want, Understanding the Enemy, Containing the Threat. Louise, welcome to KMOX.
Thank you, Paul. Delighted to be here.
Nice to have you on here. And I will tell you immediately that the thing that I know is going to annoy people who may not agree with you is that word understanding in your title, understanding the enemy, because I know what they're going to say. We don't need to understand the enemy. We just need to kill them.
Well, if by killing them you just produce more of them, it seems to me a very short-term response. Understanding doesn't mean going softly on them. It just means being more clever about containing the threat they pose to us, I believe.
All right, let's start with the first three words of the title there, what terrorists want. What do they want, or what do you think they want?
I think they want essentially two sets of things. One are political objectives, and different types of terrorist groups want different political objectives. But what all terrorist groups have in common are what I call the three R's, which are a desire for revenge, a desire for renown or glory, and a desire for reaction, to provoke us into a reaction. And I think this holds across different kinds of terrorist groups, whether you're talking about Catholics in Ireland or jihadis in Pakistan or Tamils in Sri Lanka. This desire for revenge, for glory, and to provoke a reaction is what they're looking for.
Has Al-Qaeda been successful at all three of those?
They've been enormously successful in all three of these. They haven't been at all successful in achieving their broader political goals, but they have, obviously, by killing 3,000 Americans, achieved revenge for what they perceive to be perceived atrocities by the U.S. They've certainly gotten glory. In fact, I believe that by declaring war on them, we're conceding their objectives. We're giving them glory and significance. I mean, these are, after all, a bunch of people living in caves in Afghanistan, one of the poorest countries on the world, when we decided to declare war on them and thereby elevated their stature to a degree to which they could have only dreamt. And finally, reaction. They want to provoke us into a reaction. It doesn't even matter so much for them what our reaction is, but by reacting to them, we're demonstrating to the world that they're important, that they're significant. So I believe that we're playing into their hands.
But you have to react. You can't just say, okay, well, you attacked us, or you're causing problems here, there, and everywhere, but we're going to ignore you.
No, I'm not proposing we ignore them. I'm just proposing we be smart about how we counter them and not elevate their stature. Instead, I think what we need to do, instead of using the kind of grandiose terminology they use, we need to downplay the threat that they face and then quietly and covertly undermine them. And we can do that. Lots of countries have successfully encountered terrorist movements, and I think we can learn a lot of lessons from their experience. So it's not a matter of not reacting. It's just a reaction. A matter of not confusing our strength with our ability to defeat them, because clearly we're infinitely stronger than they are, and we haven't managed to defeat them militarily, just as other countries failed to do previously.
Yeah, President Bush says we will not stop until we have defeated the terrorists. Can we?
No, we can't. I mean, it depends what you mean, of course, by defeating terrorists, but terrorism is simply a tactic, so it makes no more sense to defeat a tactic than to defeat precision-guided bombing or any other type of tactic. So defeating a tactic means making it not useful to those who use it, but by declaring war on it, we're making it very useful to those who deploy it. The people who use the tactic of terrorism, by definition, are weak. They're weaker than those they oppose. If they were stronger, they'd launch a guerrilla war, or they'd use political means, but they don't have the popular support to do that. So they use these atrocities to try and exaggerate their own importance.
You say in the book that by declaring war on terrorism, we are legitimizing not just them, but also their actions. How?
Well, again, I believe that we're elevating their stature. I don't think that Osama bin Laden and his coterie of henchmen are a worthy adversary of the United States, the most powerful country in the world. So instead of declaring war on them, which is granting them a stature that we should be denying them, And that's what I mean by saying we're playing into their hands. And in their eyes, we're legitimizing them. I obviously don't think their actions are in any sense legitimate, but I do think we're playing into their hands.
All right, but I'm confused here because maybe we're battling semantics here, but I think that you have to legitimize Osama bin Laden to make him the threat that he obviously is, not just to us, but other places, and his group of al-Qaeda followers the same, and even the expansion of al-Qaeda, which we'll get to here in just a couple of moments. In order to be able to confront those, don't you have to make public your knowledge that they are the enemy?
Well, again, I think indeed we should be making the argument publicly that you're suggesting. I think we should be arguing to the communities that produce the jihadis, the communities that produce supporters for bin Laden. We should be making our arguments to them. We should be arguing to them that we are, in fact, the good guys and the bin Ladens of this world are the bad guys. But bin Laden is able to use our actions to persuade the communities in the countries from which he is able to operate that, in fact, his vision of the world is the legitimate one and ours is not. So, indeed, I think you're right. We should be making our case. But the people we should be focused on making our case to is not the bin Ladens, whom we'll never persuade, but their potential recruits.
Talking with Louise Richardson, author of What Terrorists Want, Understanding the Enemy, Containing the Threat, here on News Talk 1120 KMOX. How do we go about making that case? How do we break the grassroots support for not just the Osama bin Ladens of the world, but even the Mohammed al-Sadrs of the world?
Well, it's not easy, but we've got a lot of weapons in our arsenal. We have our wealth, we have our technology, we have our experience in investing in other countries overseas. What we don't have is a good knowledge of the societies that we really need to influence, and that's something I think we need to address right away. One problem I will concede is that the war in Iraq, I think, is a real impediment to our making our case successfully because it is so hugely unpopular in the Middle East. And nevertheless, we should be buying up, for example, radio shows like yours and television satellites throughout the Middle East and making our case there. And we have some indications that this can work. In the case of Indonesia, for example, after the generosity of American assistance in the wake of the tsunami, public opinion polls demonstrated a huge shift in support towards the United States. Large numbers of people who had hitherto been hostile to the U.S. changed their view of the U.S. in light of the generosity of U.S. support. And Indonesia, of course, is a crucial country. It has the largest Muslim population in the world. So this is an example of the kinds of more nuanced, more political initiatives I think we should be undertaking.
Does that mean do those things and try the diplomacy and the education route rather than using force?
No, of course one has to use force, but I think it's a mistake to see military force as the solution to terrorism. It didn't work in other countries. There's no reason to believe it would work here. If you look at Peru, for example, in the Shining Path, 69,000 people were killed in the course of the campaign between the Peruvian government and the Shining Path guerrillas. Now, it's anyone's guess how many of those people were killed by the government and how many were killed by the terrorists, but that's probably not a matter of huge significance to the families of those who died. It was only when the Peruvian government decided to invest in intelligence within the police force and use good old-fashioned police intelligence to track down the leader of the Shining Path, Abel Guzman, that they were ultimately successful.
But on the other hand, can't we look at Israel versus Hezbollah recently in Lebanon? I mean, after two Israeli soldiers were kidnapped, Israel went in and used an overwhelming response. And the leader of Hezbollah said just a week or 10 days ago that he never would have had his people kidnap those two Israeli soldiers if they knew that their response would be that overwhelming. Isn't that an argument for going in that direction?
I would think quite the contrary. It's an argument for quite the opposite. I mean, Israel has wreaked extraordinary destruction on Lebanon and has probably enormously assisted the growth of Hezbollah. It's worth pointing out, too, that in the course of almost 20 years, that Israel, in spite of its vastly stronger military arsenal, was not able to defeat Hezbollah in the course of the occupation of Lebanon. So, again, if you just see it in military terms, yes, you can kill lots of terrorists, but if you generate as many new ones as you kill, you're not going to make much progress. And as we've seen, we seem to be generating them at a greater rate than we're killing them.
Let's talk a little bit about what you say in the book are the causes of terrorism. You say that the roots of terrorism are not to be found in poverty. What are they found in?
Well, unfortunately, it's very complicated. It would be very nice if we could point to a simple solution and say it's caused by, for example, poverty. But one can't. I think it requires three components. A disaffected individual, a complicit society, a community that enables this violence, and thirdly, a legitimizing ideology. Now, sometimes that ideology is religious, sometimes it's not. It doesn't matter. But if you have a disaffected individual, and you're more likely, obviously, to have a disaffected individual in a society in which there is poverty or inequality, but it's not necessarily the case. But once you have these three components, that's what it takes to generate terrorists.
Although you rarely see people joining a terrorist group who are part of a rising middle class.
That's true, but if you look at the participants of the actual, take for example the leaders of the September 11th attack, or if you look at the members of jihadi groups both in Europe and in several countries in the Middle East, actually they're certainly amongst the leadership, their education and social background is above average. They are not the destitute. The most destitute people in the world, in sub-Saharan Africa, are too busy trying to subsist to engage in terrorism. So you don't have a direct correlation. Obviously, I think poverty is a risk factor. It increases the likelihood that you'll have terrorism. But unfortunately, we're finding that many highly educated and indeed middle-class people are finding jihadi ideology quite attractive, and this is obviously a very troubling development.
And as you've written about terrorism, not just in recent years, but through the history of terrorism, going back decades, even centuries, we're not talking about crazy people here, are we?
No, I don't believe so. I think we're talking about rational organizations that are very carefully and deliberately deploying the resources they have, and their resources are usually very, very limited, and they're deploying them very, very effectively. So no, I don't think they're crazy at all, not even those who kill themselves. I think they do it for the same reason people become terrorists, and they're committed to the cause. They believe that in committing this huge sacrifice, they will further their cause, they will acquire glory for themselves, and they will be able to avenge their enemies. In this way, it's not that dissimilar from the reasons that soldiers historically have went over the trenches in the Somme or out of the foxholes in Vietnam. They were very committed to their group of peers, and they believed in the cause they were fighting for. Unfortunately, this, the same, I think, is true of terrorists today.
314-436-7900, toll-free 800-925-1120. Let's go to the phones right now. Riley, you're on KMOX. Say hello to Louise Richardson.
Hello there. Kind of interested in what you're talking about there, but I have one question. Clinton sent the soldiers over to help them whenever they were all being slaughtered over there, but I didn't hear him say thank you or kiss my foot or anything.
When you say over there, you mean when he sent them to Mogadishu in Somalia?
Yes.
Louise?
Hello, Riley. Thank you for your question. Well, I don't think as the most powerful country in the world we can make our policy on whether or not people are grateful to us. I think by necessity, any hegemon or the most powerful country in the world is always going to be resented. And I don't think we should worry about the fact that we're not universally loved. The Roman Empire was not universally loved. The British Empire was not universally loved. I can say that as an Irish person. So I don't think we should worry about the fact that people may not express gratitude towards us. I don't think that's why we conduct our foreign policy. And I don't think we should worry about the fact that we're not loved. I think the threshold, what we need to worry about, is whether people are prepared to be complicit or to support those who are prepared to murder our civilians. That's the only threshold we need to worry about. And that's a threshold we should be able to achieve because, frankly, killing civilians violates every code of conduct and every religion and every cultural norm.
But doesn't winning them over mean winning their hearts and minds and, you know, getting them on our side?
Well, yes, ideally, one would like them all to share our values, but I think that's being a little ambitious. I think what we need to do, or what I would be most concerned about, is just ensuring that they won't support those who are prepared to commit terrorist acts against us. That we should be able to achieve, I think.
Yeah, I don't think they have to share our values at all. I don't frankly care if they share my values, as long as they don't stop me from having mine.
Right. Right, agreed.
314-436-7900, toll-free 800-925-1120. Kevin, you're on KMOX. Hello.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to discusses your guest that she says we need to talk to these people more and negotiate with them. And she compared them to regular soldiers and to a regular army, when in fact they are nothing but terrorists. And they've stated over and over again that their goal is to destroy the West and to destroy America. So I don't see how she can put the two in the same category and expect this country to be able to work some kind of miracle when it's their goal to destroy us to start with.
So Louise?
Thank you for your question, Kevin. And actually, I think you raised three points there. The one is the comparison with an army. You're quite right. They're very different. A terrorist group is not the same as an army, but there are similarities. And I think the motivating force, my point was simply that what drives an individual to put his life on the line is similar, I think, for terrorists or members of an army. You can accept or reject that if you like. As to negotiating with them, well, my concern is to how do we most effectively stop, contain the threat they pose to us. And I think the experience of the British government in Northern Ireland, for example, demonstrates that once the British government started talking to the IRA and the representatives of the IRA, they understood the organization so much better. They understood its weak points. They understood how to exploit the the tendencies to split within an organization. They use that knowledge that they gained from negotiation to their advantage and ultimately turning the IRA towards the political means to achieve their objectives. And as to goals, my argument is that, in fact, their goals are, as I said, revenge, renown, and reaction. I don't think it's the case that they particularly want to destroy the West. They actually believe that the West is trying to destroy them. I mean, if you read Bin Laden's statements time and time again, he invokes examples going back to the early bombing of Shia sites, for example, in the Lebanon, that propelled him to decide to adopt terrorism as a response to what he perceived as our war on them. So I think we can be more effective against them if we understand their thinking better. It doesn't mean we have to like them, but if we understand their thinking better, I think we can forge a more effective counterterrorism policy.
314-436-7900, toll-free 800-925-1120. Tom, you're on KMOX. It's the Paul Harris Show. Say hello to Louise Richardson.
Hi there.
As
I recall, we spent years in the Carter administration and in the Clinton administration doing exactly what Louise is recommending. We reached out to them, we talked to them, we negotiated with them, didn't get us support anywhere. Time to do something different.
Well, I think it depends who you're talking about. I don't think that, the Carter administration and the Clinton administration were not, well, certainly the Carter administration was not dealing with the likes of Bin Laden. The Clinton administration was. I don't think the Clinton administration was trying to talk to them. I think the Clinton administration was trying to kill Bin Laden, came very close to killing him, indeed, in 1998. I think there are very important distinctions to be drawn between the different adversaries we face. I assume in the Carter case you're talking about Iran and Carter's efforts to adopt a human rights approach to the world. We have tried the military approach. It hasn't worked either. I think that had we looked at other countries' experience in countering terrorism, we would have realized that the military approach alone simply won't work because terrorists pose a political, not a military threat to us. We're infinitely stronger than they are. So the nature of the threat, I think, is political rather than military.
I'm talking this afternoon with Louise Richardson, who has a book called What Terrorists Want, Understanding the Enemy, Containing the Threat. She's executive dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study and a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School. And we were talking a few minutes ago. I asked you about Israel and Hezbollah and how Israel had used overwhelming force in Lebanon against Hezbollah. And you said that that had probably created more support for Hezbollah in Lebanon. Do you believe that the United States' actions of the last 5 years have bred more terrorists?
Yes, I do, without a doubt. I think we can see this in Iraq on a daily basis. The foreign fighters who have gone to Iraq have, by and large, have been relatively young and were radicalized by the war in Iraq. We saw this with the London bombers, the young men who planted the bomb last summer, July 7th, in the London underground. killing themselves and 52 others. Their leader, Sadiq Khan, issued a video in which he talked explicitly about the war in Iraq as something that had mobilized and radicalized himself and his followers. So unfortunately, I think that, yes, in our conduct of the war, we have produced more enemies for ourselves.
Do you think that we also did that with our actions against Afghanistan in the months after 9/11?
No, I think Afghanistan was a very different story. I think there we had international support. People under the international community understood what we were doing. We were going after the people who had committed this extraordinary atrocity against us. That it is the case that large numbers of civilians died unwittingly, I mean, inadvertently, were killed by our bombing raids there, far more people than had been killed on September 11th. But I think the international community saw this as an entirely legitimate action, a legitimate response to the atrocity that had been perpetrated against us. But the same, I think, is not true in Iraq.
Plus, somebody needed to put their big, heavy boot down on the neck of the Taliban and squish it. Unfortunately, didn't get it all the way, but at least we cut off the blood for a little while.
Well, unfortunately, we took our eye off the ball, and we didn't concentrate on getting the actual perpetrators of the violence. We let bin Laden and al-Zawahiri and several of his senior people get away. We also let the leader of the Taliban, of course, get away.
Yep. Let's go back to the phones here. Clark, you're on KMOX with Louise Richardson. Hello.
Good afternoon. In reference to the idea of trying to negotiate with the terrorists, I have a little disagreement in that respect. I don't believe we can negotiate with the terrorists. The terrorists are a sect of the Muslims, and their sect believes in that they should defeat the infidels at all costs, and referring to people that are not Muslims in their world. Muslim friends that I have here in the United States that are, as parentheses, normal as you and I, who have the beliefs that you and I have, refer to them as fundamentalist Muslims, the terrorists, that they're fundamentalists. That's the way they refer to them. So I don't believe, in respect to the subject of negotiation, that we're going to be able to negotiate with them. That's my comment.
Okay, I agree that there are many terrorist groups that there are no point in negotiating with, and there are many terrorist groups that it does make sense to negotiate with. It depends on the nature of their goals. If they have a political goal, these goals can be negotiated. The classic examples would be the Basques in Spain, the Kurds in Turkey, the Tamils in Sri Lanka, the Catholics in Northern Ireland, and so on.
What about Al-Qaeda?
Well, Al-Qaeda, it's an interesting fact. Do we know whether their goals are negotiable or not? The fact is, I don't think we even know whether they've got negotiable goals or not. My sense of it is that they don't. But I think it seems to me that this is something that needs to be established rather than asserted. At this point, there isn't anybody there with whom one could negotiate on behalf of Al-Qaeda because the center of the organization has been so badly damaged by us. So I'm not actually advocating negotiating with Al-Qaeda because I'm not sure that there's somebody one could negotiate with. I do think it's a mistake to say one should never negotiate with terrorists. I think it depends. But I also think it needs to be, as I say, established rather than asserted that their goals are completely unnegotiable.
But the main part of your thesis is that we need to understand them and cut them off at the grassroots level and not create more terrorists.
Exactly.
You say in the book, Louise, that the threat from Al-Qaeda has changed. How?
I think it's changed because, as I mentioned, it's no longer the central organization operating in a territory that enabled it to operate very freely. So in Afghanistan, for example, it could have quite relatively easily had the freedom to develop weapons of mass destruction, for example. Given the success of our operation in Afghanistan in seriously disrupting the operation, the threat from Al-Qaeda has been transformed from a particular organization to a much more diffuse. Al-Qaeda is now more a mobilizing ideology than anything else. So it does make it much more difficult for them to plan any complex operation or to plan the acquisition of weapons of mass destruction. On the other hand, it makes it much more likely that groups around the world and any part of the world will be radicalized, attracted by their ideology, radicalized by it, and then take action against us.
Freelancers rather than official members.
Exactly.
Yeah. What do we do with countries that support and sponsor terrorism? I'm not just talking about Iran, but I've talked often about Saudi Arabia, which calls itself our partner in peace, but still allows these madrasas to teach their kids hatred of the West, hatred of the United States, and so on and so on. And so many of the people who grew up to be the people who flew those planes into our buildings on 9/11 did come from exactly that culture. What do we do about the Saudi Arabias and other so-called partners in peace?
Well, our other biggest problem, of course, is Pakistan, which has been a partner in peace, as you say, but also has produced a large number of the members of al-Qaeda, and particularly, as we've seen in England, have very close ties to the radical groups in England, and of course have been active in India for a long time. Well, our government has a position of declaring who are the sponsors of terrorism, and neither Pakistan nor Saudi Arabia are on that list. Now, if a country is on the list, there are mandatory sanctions attached to it. And unfortunately, this list has always been a fairly political instrument. I think you're quite right that Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, unofficially at any rate, have been enormously supportive of terrorist groups. This has not been the official action of the state, but it's been more unofficial, but devastating nevertheless. But because these states have never made it onto the State Department list of sponsors of terrorism, none of the sanctions apply to them.
Yeah, we need to get them on the list, and we need to have Pakistan not look the other way about the Osama bin Laden and his supporters, and even those freelance groups that we're talking about who have taken all these actions in London as well. I think that that is one of the major root causes of terrorism in the world, and I wish it were being more addressed. Anyway, the book is called What Terrorists Want, Understanding the Enemy, Containing the Threat. Louise, I thank you for your time this afternoon.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
Louise Richardson here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.